So at the Buddhist Film Festival last weekend, they showed the film Cave in the Snow by Tenzin Palmo. A documentary about Tenzin Palmo, and she had this very interesting conversation with the Dalai Lama. At one point, Dalai Lama kind of emphasized that he was a follower of the Buddha and especially the teachings of Nagarjuna. And then Tenzin Palmo then said, well, Nagarjuna really didn't like women either, did he? She's a very unstoppable force. Dalai Lama just laughed and said, whoa, 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 whoa. And Shanti Deva, they said also as well, as that figure. But yeah, but I'm not sure. All of those things have to be understood within the realization that there are many, many things attributed to these authors, especially Nagarjuna in the Tibetan tradition, which probably aren't by him. And obviously, you can see, you know, this is regarded as his central work, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, and it's a very abstract philosophical work. And don't find anything. Might be construed as misogynistic in there. There might be something, I don't know. I'm not familiar with all of his works, but I suspect.
I'm a bit confused that Nagarjuna actually wrote the Hasutta, so the Hasutta had nothing to do with Nagarjuna?
Except for a philosophical affinity.
So they have similar theme and people draw from Nagarjuna to write the Hasutta.
Hard to say which one's first and which one's second, yeah.
Okay,
similar. We don't have firm dates for either of them.
Okay, but he did write.
He probably. I mean, he might have done. He might have dashed it off on a weekend once when he didn't have anything else to do, but it's unlikely. I mean, the sutras, of course, always sort of emerge rather than having authors. So they don't actually have explicit authors, where Nagarjuna is the writer of Shastras, so he wrote books and signed his name to them.
So no one
knows
who actually wrote.
Same with all the sutras. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to have a bit more of a look at Mula Madhyamaka Karika. And just to remind you that, you know, this is, Nagarjuna is one of the most difficult philosophers anywhere, of any persuasion. And so, we don't expect to be able to sort of get to the heart and understand everything about what he was about. I certainly don't. And I certainly find his use of logic and language to be extremely elusive. But I think it's worth just getting an idea of the kind of things which he was saying. Getting a bit of familiarity, and then that means that we've got a bit of an opening if we want to go back and look at it in more detail. And if we start to be aware of some of the issues that he discusses, then when those issues come up or they become problems for us or become interested in them, then we can have a look at it in more detail. That also helps us in some ways to understand statements like that. You know, when the Dalai Lama says, okay, he's mainly a follower of Nagarjuna, then that's an important statement. Dalai Lama is very influential. Now, he speaks not just to him, but for the majority of the Tibetan Sangha who would see themselves as followers of this school. So it's worth seeing exactly what they mean when they say that. What kind of things are they following? So what I've done... I've selected just a few of Nagarjuna's verses, which we'll go through and have a look at this afternoon. We won't try to look through the whole thing. Okay, so just to come back to this verse here. This is reiterating, this is part of the fifth chapter, on the examination of elements or dhatus. Dhatus. Siddhartha, yeah. And this verse here is like a summary of Nagarjuna's philosophy, anyway. Astitvam yetu pasyanti nastitvam chalpabuddhaya. Those who see existence and non-existence are of little intelligence or little wisdom. Okay, so here's Buddha meaning intelligence. So sees existence and non-existence of bhavas, of existent or substantially existing things, and they do not see the auspicious, the Shiva, the stilling of the object, of the drashta. Okay, so just to repeat the verse, those who see the existence and non-existence of existent things are of little intelligence, and they do not see the peace, the sublime, and the stilling of objects, or of this word here is more or less a synonym for sankharas, of conditioned things. Okay, so here, of course, when he's referring to that, remembering always that he's critiquing the what he would regard as a naive realism of the Abhidhamma schools, and so it says who he's referring to. Okay, so all the Abhidhamma scholars are of little intelligence, because they're focusing on the existence or non-existence of substantial entities, i.e. they're trying to describe what kinds of things either exist or don't exist in the world. And by focusing always on this kind of categorizing, analyzing, identifying things as either being or not being, then they're missing out on seeing the auspicious, the Shivan, the stilling, the peacefulness of activities of sankharas. So very much a very good summary of this whole. Yeah, they're getting caught up in the stuff of the world.
Is that something that are they concerned with the things rather than the processes?
In a certain sense, yeah. You always have to be you always have to be careful. With Nagarjuna. Pradipenanda karosti. Okay. Pradipen. Okay, so this is some of his reflections on light and darkness. And remember that we mentioned at the beginning that there are some of the sutta passages which Nagarjuna relies on, and which he extends arguments which you find in the suttas, and one of those is in the Dhatu Sanyutta, where the Buddha says that the element of light is made known dependent on the element of darkness. In other words, that these are interdependent concepts, they're related concepts. And so here, Nagarjuna extends that argument. There exists no darkness, either in the light or in whatever place it is situated. What does light illuminate? For illumination is indeed the destruction of darkness. How can darkness be destroyed by the emergent light, when the emerging light indeed does not teach? Is that right? Does not teach praputer? I'm not sure why he said not teach. Does not teach darkness? Perhaps it does not reach darkness? I'm not sure if that's a misprint or not. Anyway. So the basic idea here is that the light isn't, again, it's just difficult to say it without sort of twisting up in language, but the idea is that where there is light, then there's no darkness. So the light doesn't actually reach or go into the darkness, because by the time the light is there, the darkness isn't there. So this idea that they're relative concepts. So there's not it's just the idea that there's no substantial thing that we call a darkness or substantial thing that we call light. make sense? Yes. Okay. Yes, exactly. It's a perceived light, not physical light. Yeah. Okay, so in these few verses here, Nagarjuna addresses one of the main philosophical problems of the Abhidhamma. Now, in the sutta, of course, one of the basic teachings we know that the Buddha taught was the teaching of impermanence. Okay, everything is impermanent, and he spoke always about arising, ceasing, and he spoke birth, aging, and death, and so on. Now, but he also spoke, but when you look at, say, birth, aging, and death, well, there's a period of time involved, isn't there? One's born, and then one ages, and then one dies. And similarly, we talk about arising and ceasing, but also in the suttas, it sort of says that the conditioned things arise, they persist, and they cease. Okay, so it's not just arising and ceasing. And it says that the change while persisting is evident. Okay? So in other words, from the sutta point of view, change isn't simply the fact that things arise and cease, but things also change while they're actually present, which of course is very easy to understand when we're talking about, say, a whole human life, okay? One aspect of impermanence is that people aren't there, then they appear, they're born, and then later on they die. But another aspect of impermanence is that while they're alive, they're continually changing, okay? So this is what the Buddha was pointing to, and that's probably what he was mainly meaning, right? But that teaching then becomes very difficult to apply when we apply it to the concept of momentariness, which the post-Abhidhamic philosophers had developed. And so according to the developed Abhidhamma philosophy, after the canonical Abhidhamma, all conditioned things exist only momentarily. Okay, so they exist, they arise and they cease in an instant. Now, if things are arising and ceasing in an instant, it becomes difficult to explain what do you mean by saying that they arise, they change while they're remaining, and then they cease. And so the different Abhidhamma schools approach this question in different ways. So, for example, the Satrantika school eliminated the moment of standing, and they said that when the Buddha spoke of the moment of standing, of remaining, of things that remain, when I say standing, I'm just using that because that's the actual Indic idiom, tishtati or tikkati in Pali, is to remain or to stand. So the Satrantikas argued that when the Buddha said that things change while they're remaining, he was speaking on a relative level, but on an ultimate level, on the scale of moments, there's no remaining, there's just arising and ceasing. Which again, causes problems, philosophical problems. But in any case, the Theravadins believe that things that there were three sub-moments. So that things only exist for a moment, but that moment can be divided into sub-moments, or three sub-moments, arising, remaining, and ceasing. Okay? And the Sarvasivadins, of course, because the Sarvasivadins always wanted to extend the notion of time. So they're always kind of stretching time out. So they said there's four sub-moments. Okay? There's arising, there's remaining, there's decay, or jara, and then there's ceasing. Okay? So they said that this change while remaining, they got around that by dividing the middle moment into two. Okay? So this is philosophical problem which the Abhidhamma theorists had encountered, and which Nagarjuna addresses in his characteristically way of being both incredibly dismissive and also completely abstruse as to why he's being so dismissive as well. Duration of an existent thing, as always, the bhava. So the duration of an existent thing that is ceasing. Have I got the right verse here? Duration. Sithir. No, I've got the wrong verse. Here we go. Yes. Duration of an existent thing, the bhava, that is ceasing, is not appropriate. Okay. Whatever existence that is non-ceasing is also not appropriate. Okay? Does not apply, is not relevant, or it's not a meaningful way of speaking, something like that. Yeah. So in other words, if you're saying that something exists, but you're also saying it's ending, then that's not an appropriate way of speaking, because you're talking about something that's disappearing. How can you say it's something that exists when it's disappearing? It's like saying that, it's like saying it at sunset. If you say the day remains, how can you say the day remains if it's sunset? Okay, what you say is if the day is ending. Yeah? So if it's ending, then it's not appropriate to say that it is. But yeah, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, so you're misapplying language. So it's just pointing to this inapplicability of that. When all existence, okay, sarva bhavesu, and again the bhava, we find constantly through this, the existent things, when all existent things are always of the nature of aging and death, jara marana dharmesu, what existence that are without aging and death can remain? Okay? So since the existence always have the nature of an aging and death, how can we speak about them remaining and standing? So this is some of the things on the remaining. It is, yeah. So it's not a problem when speaking about the aging and death of people, but this, that's not what he's actually arguing against. He's arguing against the Abhidharma doctrine. That's what he's talking about, the Bhavas.
Mm.
And so in that case, aging and death is used in a metaphorical sense. Yeah. Hitir. Okay, Pale. Thought is even too complicated, so it would be, yeah, like a moment of feeling, yeah? Feeling, a moment of consciousness, a moment of arising of a material object. Your cup of tea would be, like, you think of the existence of the atoms that make up the cup of tea, is what he's talking about. Something like that. Okay, when the fruit does not exist, pale asati, the fruit, yep. No, this is fruit in the Dhamma sense of fruit, the result of practice. There is neither release nor is there the way to heaven. Path to heaven. And therefore, this would apply sarvak of all actions, nairarthakyang would have no effect. Okay, so this would imply, so if there was no fruit, then this would imply that, then, sorry, if there was no fruit, then there would be no path to release or to heaven, and this would imply the inefficacy of all action. Okay, so here, it's again part of a discussion of Nagarjuna's notion of dependence and conditionality, where he was criticizing the notion of a cause and an effect being separate things. And I just wanted to refer to this one because it just to just show that even though he operates on this very kind of refined sort of metaphysical, philosophical level, but he's still sort of acknowledging here these two paths, the way to release and the way to heaven, as found in popular Buddhism. And the next one I thought was fairly relevant. Yarindhanang, okay, if, and this is about fire and fuel, right? If fire were to be fuel, then there would be an identity of agent and action, okay? If the fuel, the indha, were the fire, the agni, then there would be an ekatva, a oneness of actor and action, katra and karmana. So again, this is the same idea that I just mentioned just now, that if that if the fire is talking about the relationship between the effect and the cause, how do you understand the effect and the cause? So here he's saying that you can't say that they're the same thing. Right? You can't say that the effect is the same thing as the cause. The fire is the same thing as the fuel. And then if fire were to be different from fuel, then it would exist even without the fuel. Okay? So if you say fire is something separate from fuel, then you could have fire which would be different from fuel. And equally, you could have fuel which would be different from fire, which is also an interesting point.
You mean separate?
I mean independently existent things. Now actually, of course, you can't have something, because the fuel really is that which produces fire. Yeah? So something which is not producing fire is not fuel, because it's not performing the function of fuel. So we have our firewood downstairs, and it's not producing fire at the moment. So you can't really call it fuel, can you? Because it's just sitting there. It's no more fuel than the wood in this floor is. We think of the wood in this floor as not being fuel. What's the actual fuel for the fire is the fire that's actually burning in the fireplace. Yeah? And so, so each of those concepts is dependent on the other. If the fire is not produced, then the fuel is not fuel because it's not producing any cause. And if there's no fuel, of course, then there's no fire. So these two are relative concepts, just like the darkness and the light are relative to each other, the fuel and the fire and so on. And the reason that he's, Nagarjuna has used this, he gives a whole chapter, actually, to this discussion of the fire and the fuel, because it's a very predominant set of imagery in Buddhism, which you find a lot in the suttas. This whole imagery of the fire and the fuel is one of the major sort of metaphorical languages that's used in the suttas. And also it's used a lot in the, say, Upanishadic context. And Kalapahana here argues that it was the major argument also used by the Pugalavadins, who are the Buddhist school who tried to establish what they call a Pugala, an individual, which existed neither separate from or the same as the five aggregates. So this Pugalavadin school, of course, all the other schools of Buddhism regarded them as being heretics. They regarded them as falling onto a teaching of a self or an Atman. But they argued that their Pugala that they talked about was neither identical with nor separate from the five aggregates, but existed in dependence on the five aggregates in the same way that the fire exists independence on the fuel. Okay, so they tried to establish it in that way through using this kind of argument. And so this whole chapter here is sort of engaging with this argument of the Pugalavada's teaching on the individual, the person. Exactly, yeah. They're relative concepts, they exist in dependence on each other.
So how is that a critique of the Savastivadins?
No, it's a critique of, could be a critique of the Savastivadins as well, but he was saying that it was a critique of the Pugalavadins. Where the Pugalavadins teach that the Pugala, or the individual, arises in dependence on the five aggregates. And so he's pointing out that almost like that there's a substratum of the five aggregates, and that the Pugala, the individual, sort of arises on top of that, whereas Nagarjuna is arguing that the fire and the fuel actually depend on each other. That Pugalavadin view you could compare with the modern scientific view, which says that consciousness arises, it's like an epiphenomenon. You know the word epiphenomenon? They use that in modern philosophy to describe like that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain. Okay? So when as nervous systems organize themselves and so on, at a certain point in organization arises this epiphenomenon that we call consciousness. So it sort of arises from and sort of sits on top of that earlier thing, that earlier construction. So in that idea of an epiphenomenon, it implies a one-way causality. so that the brain causes this consciousness thing, but the consciousness doesn't then influence the brain.
But the Buddha didn't say the effect is also dependent on the cause is also dependent on the effect.
In some context he did, yeah. Yeah. And in some context it talks about the interdependence of things, like say nama rupa and vijnana, independent origination. That nama rupa conditions vijnana and vijnana also conditions nama rupa. Yeah. So this again is a similar kind of idea. Yeah. So when we understand like that, then you understand things in terms of systems and cycles. And when you speak of one aspect of that conditionality, then you always understand that that's merely just a looking at that one aspect in that particular context, but actually there's a whole cycle. You know, so you could say, the rain causes the trees to grow, yeah? So we can say because of the rainfall, therefore the trees can grow because they can get water. But actually also the trees are participating in that cycle, which also influences the atmosphere and also influences the formation of rain. When we cut all the trees down, then the rain doesn't fall either. So we look at one, you can look at any one time, you can look at one aspect of that. You isolate and look at one aspect of it so you can understand that. But you always have to understand that it's actually happening in a much greater context, where the causality is happening in very complex ways. So what Nagarjuna is again criticizing is that tendency. It's very similar to a modern scientific tendency to sort of take that one aspect and to look at it exclusively as something which is independent of everything else.
So in a way, Nagarjuna, many of his ideas, they're kind of, in his way, it's quite founded on the suttas. He just uses a much more philosophical way of presenting.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and not only are they, I mean, one can argue to the extent that they are or they are not. I think they are. Most modern commentators do tend to think that they are, but it's clearly the case that he was concerned to present them as if they were founded on the suttas, right? So and so he was trying to persuade people who already accepted the suttas and could be persuaded by these kinds of arguments. Yeah. Okay, and this is another example of exactly that point. Purva prajnayati gorti netyuvacha mahamuni. The beginning point, right, is not made known, and this was said by the great sage. Okay, so here he's referring to, of course, one of the most famous statements from the suttas, that the first point of samsara is not known, panyayati, not made known. The life process samsaro navaragro he nasadir chapi pashming is without beginning and end. There is neither a beginning nor an end. Yeah, one could argue that Nagarjuna is overstepping what the Buddha said here, and what the Buddha said is that there's no beginning that's known, and I'm not aware that he ever said that there's no ending to samsara. Of course, Nibbana being the ending of samsara, but here he's talking about samsara in the whole sense. But he is repeating that idea that there's no first point of samsara. But that bit he would regard as more or less fairly obvious. Most people would tend to agree with that. But then the next one, he then goes on to say, well, if there's that which has neither beginning nor end, okay, if there's neither the beginning nor the end, how could you say that there's a middle? Right? It's true, isn't it? Yeah? How can you say that there's an in-between if you don't know if it's in-between what? Yeah. So, therefore, the methods of distinguishing the beginning, the end, or both together, the middle, are not appropriate. If birth were to come first, there's another good argument here, if birth were to come first, right, and then later on, aging and death, okay, now that sounds like a fairly obvious proposition, yeah, first of all comes birth, and then comes aging and death, yeah, yeah. Then birth itself would be without aging and death. Okay? Nirjara marana jatir bhavej. And an immortal would thus be born. Is that? If there was first birth, if it was the case that first there was birth.
But he's speaking in a sort of absolute sense, like first in the beginning, like in the
Not here yet.
Just in terms of one life.
Bit hard to say. He's not specific. It could. The language that he's using is most normally used to describe just one life.
Well, if he's just describing one life,
yeah.
Birth comes first.
Yeah.
And then later on,
aging and death. Yeah.
What's his contention about that?
Then birth would be without aging and death,
well,
and then what was born would be an immortal.
But birth isn't without aging.
So it's not the case that birth comes first and then aging and death comes. But and then is that being then immortal at that time?
No.
Again, he's criticizing this idea that you can have like a separate thing, which is birth. So you have a separate identifiable moment here, which is birth, and then later on you have separate identifiable things, which are aging and death. Yeah? Okay, so then next one is actually one of Nagarjuna's most memorable and verses. Shunyata sarva drishtinang prokta nisvaranang jinai yeshang tu shunyata drishti tang asadhyang bhabha shire. The victorious ones, the jinas, the conquerors, which means the Buddhas, have announced that emptiness is the relinquishing of all views. Those who are possessed of the view of emptiness are said to be incorrigible. Right. Incurable. Yeah. Absolutely, this is a very, very, normal thing to find in Buddhist circles. Yeah.
So what would he say about his followers?
Probably the same thing that most religious leaders would say about most of his followers. I think someone like the Dalai Lama, I would say, is very it's a very flexible way of thinking, you know, he's not at all dogmatic in his teaching of emptiness and so on. But, yeah. Okay, next one. Yeah, okay. In the exhortation to Katyayana, so here's the one of the only places where Nagarjuna literally refers to one of the suttas by name, is of course being the Katyayana Vada Sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Nidana Samyutta. In the Katyayana Sutta, then both existence and non-existence, the two of them, have been refuted by the Blessed One, who is adept at both existence as well as non-existence. So this is, again, this is very, very, very central, and it's quite, you know, reasonable to understand that Nagarjuna's entire argument is basically an extension of this argument from the Katyayana Sutta. And a little bit further down, he makes explicit something which is often implicit, exists, using the same phrasing here as using to describe the Katyayana Sutta, asti, exists implies grasping, graha, at eternalism. Nasti, non-existence implies the view of the philosophy of annihilationism. Therefore, a discerning person, vichakshana, should not rely on either existence or non-existence. Okay, so this is following again from a position which is, as far as I'm aware, is only explicitly stated once in the suttas, and that's in one of the discussions with Vachagota, where Vachagota says, ati atta. Ask the question, ati atta, is there a self? Or nati atta, is there no self? And if the Buddha says, if I said there is a self, then this would imply eternalism. And if I said there is no self, nati atta, then this would apply annihilationism. So this idea of nastita in Indian thought, the way of thinking about existence, doesn't necessarily imply that something never is, just the absence of things, but it implies their destruction and their ending. So this is why it's always identified with the theory of annihilationism. So this is another verse here, chapter 17, examination of the fruit of action. He says, defilements, kilesa, karma, actions, dehash, bodies, agents, kartarash, and fruits, palanicha, Gandharva Nagaraka Marichi Swapna Samnibha are comparable to the cities of the Gandharvas, or to a mirage, or to a dream. Is the city of Gandharva the clouds? Huh. Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
Is it talking about Gandhara, the place?
No, Gandharva, the celestial beings.
Oh.
Yeah, they're always supposed to be flying in the sky and stuff. I don't know, maybe. Yeah. I always thought it meant the heavenly city, but that's right, it could well have been conceived as being the clouds. I'm not quite sure about that point. But they do have the cloud devas as well, which is a separate thing.
So what does that mean?
What he's talking about is all of these... things which are talked about, which are these are fundamental categories in the Abhidhamma, and the kilesas, the karmas, and so on, which the Abhidhamma was concerned to categorize and describe, and so on, and which according to the Abhidhamma are bhavas or swabhavas, that they are really, truly, woolly existent things. And he says that they're like the cities of the Gandharvas, like a dream or a mirage. And so what the Abhidhamma analysis would be to say that the self, what you take to be a self, is like the city of the Gandharvas, or like a mirage, or like a dream. And what really exists is the defilements, the karmas, and so on. So that would be the Abhidhamma argument, the reductionist argument. Whereas Nagarjuna's argument is that these things, which the Abhidhamma regards as absolutely existing, are just as much illusory as anything else. So again, these are classic imagery that found the city of the Gandharvas and the mirage and dreams and things like that are classic imagery found in Buddhism. And you find similar imagery found in the Nidana Sanghita. And as Bhikkhu Bodhi pointed out in one of his comments on this, that none of these things are actually completely non-existent. Okay? Dreams are not non-existent. They're just illusory. They're just not what they seem to be. The same thing, a mirage is not a nothing. Yeah? It's actually a something, but it's not what it seems to be. And so all of these things, like a reflection in the mirror, or like a magician's trick, or something like that, they're always something, but they're a delusory something. So you can't. It's important to understand that. And in using this, he's not saying that they don't exist. He's merely saying that their appearance is delusory, and we can't conclude that they exist in a substantial sense. So this is a nice verse here. Independently realized, aparapratyang, this is a word that's used in the suttas to describe the stream enterer, who's not dependent on another. Okay, so aparapratyang, so something that means you realize for yourself. Peaceful. Shantang. Unobsessed by obsessions, or unproliferated by proliferations. Nirvikalpam, without discriminations or imaginations. Ananartam, without a variety, without many meanings. This is the characteristic of truth.
What was that first word?
Aparapratyaya. Yeah, not dependent on another. So in here you can also see the Nagarjuna, that tendency which you find in Nagarjuna, and which is brought out explicitly in some of the Mahayana sutras, where they again pointing to the fact that the Abhidhamma scholars are always kind of arguing about the nature of things, which way do we categorize things? Is this part of that, or is that part of this one? And so it gets more and more complicated. So these systems have become very 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 complicated. And obsessed with diversity, sort of an assumption that there's an actual diversity of many existing real things. And so here Nagarjuna is sort of repeating, which is I think one of the great insights of the Buddha and of many great sages, which is actually that the truth that matters is the truth which is not complicated and is not proliferated, and that truth which is very peaceful. And so as long as the truth is something that we're arguing about, then it's not really true.
You're going from verse to verse through this.
Yeah.
All the bits between, is it just a series of lines? Assuming they're all sort of connected somehow.
There is a
discourse or some sort of logical dialogue happening.
Theories, yeah, and by doing this, we're not giving due respect to that. We did that a bit more last week when we went through the first chapter a bit more sequentially. But yes, you're quite right. It's arranged in terms of chapters. So there's 27 chapters, and each of them deals with a particular topic. So one of them is called examination of self-nature. Another one's examination of fruit of action, examination of self, examination of time. And so on. So we're just taking isolated verses. And then this is another nice little summary verse here. It is without an ekaratang, with not one meaning, with not many meanings, with not annihilated and not permanent. Okay, this is the immortal message, the deathless dispensation of the Buddhas, of the lords of the world, Lokanatha.
So, now I'd like to just take a bit more of a, look at in detail at one of the most important of Nagarjuna's chapters, and that's the chapter Examination of the Noble Truths. And here Nagarjuna very directly confronts his critics. And so he starts out by saying, if all of this is empty, then there exists no arising and ceasing. And this implies the non-existence of the Four Noble Truths. Okay? So here he's responding very directly. He's speaking with the voice of a critic, presumably, who's arguing with him and who's accusing him of destroying the Four Noble Truths. And in the absence of the Four Noble Truths, then understanding, relinquishing, development, cultivation, and realization. Okay, understanding, relinquishing, cultivation, and witnessing are not appropriate. Okay, so these refer to the four functions regarding the Four Noble Truths that are taught in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha's first discourse. The first noble truth of suffering is to be fully known, parinya. The second noble truth of the origin of suffering is to be abandoned, prahana. The fourth noble truth of the path is bhavetabha, to be developed. And the third noble truth of nibbana is to be realized, to be witnessed, sakshikaroti in Pali, sakshikarma. Yeah. In the absence of these four, in absence of these things, then the Four Noble Truths would be not be evident. The Four Noble Fruits would not be evident. In the absence of the fruits, then those who have attained the fruits, or those who are on the way to attaining the fruits, would not exist. So here he's referring to the those standing in the fruits is the one who's realized the fruit of stream entry, one return, non-returner, and arahant. And then this is the pratipanaka, is the one who's practicing, usually called the Magapugala, or the one who's on the path to stream entry, on the path to one return, on the path to non-return, on the path to arahantship. So here again he's continuing the argument. If we don't have any noble truths, then there's nothing to do or practice with regard to those noble truths. If there's no practice with regard to the noble truths, then there's nobody who's realized. Then if there's no one who's realized the noble truth, then there's no sangha. And then if there's no sangha, then and no noble truths, then there would be no dhamma, no true dhamma. And then if there's no dhamma and there's no sangha, then how could there be a Buddha? Speaking in this manner, again Nagarjuna continuing with the voice of the opponent, then you contradict the three jewels, three ratnas, as well as the reality of the fruits, both good and bad, and all such worldly conventions. Okay, so this is very kind of interesting as kind of being an example of the kind of criticism which Nagarjuna obviously had encountered, which he thought was needed rebutting. And his response here, typically straightforward. We say, we say that you do not comprehend the purpose of emptiness. As such, you are tormented by emptiness and the meaning of emptiness. Vihanyase. Okay, so you're tormented by emptiness because you don't understand it properly. Then goes on to the next one. Dve satye. The teachings of the Buddha is based on two truths. Dharma deshana. The loka samvriti satyam. The truth which is the conventions of the world. Loka is the world, samvriti, the convention, and satya the truth, and the satyam which is paramarthata, which is relating to, which is the highest or the ultimate truth, relating to the highest goal. I'm just wondering where the two go through. So this we discussed this a little bit last week, that this notion of the two truths is often stated to be a fundamental teaching of Nagarjuna, and yet in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika we only find it stated at one point. Okay, now and so this is questionable the extent to which you could say it's a fundamental teaching, although to be fair, it's put at a fairly fundamental place in his argument. Yeah, I mean he's fundamentally addressing the most basic criticisms of his teaching and saying that, well, to understand that you have to understand this teaching taught by the, which he claims is taught by the Buddha. Of course, it's not actually taught by the Buddha, the teaching of the two truths. It's not found in the suttas. Okay, but I'll just read through Kalapahana's discussion of this. In the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha, so remembering that Kalapahana is attempting to articulate and defend a position which says that Nagarjuna's teaching was is in agreement with the teaching of the suttas, that he didn't fall into the fallacies which so many of the later philosophers did. So this is the position which Kalapahana is trying to articulate here. In the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha condemned any attempt to uphold a view as the ultimate, refusing to recognize any knowledge of things as they really are, okay, and making a more sober claim to knowledge of, quote, things as they have come to be, yathabhuta. So this is referring to the phrase yathabhuta jnana dasana. It's a very common phrase in the suttas, usually translated as knowledge of things as they really are. But the word bhuta doesn't mean things are. Remembering how nuanced and important our use of the words around being and existence are. So if you say something is, then according to what we've just heard from Nagarjuna, then you're implying eternally exists or absolutely exists. So the Buddha, instead of using the word bhava or ati, which we find is what Nagarjuna is critiquing here, the Buddha used the word bhuta, which is what has been produced by conditions, what has come to be. And so he said that the Buddha said things as they have come to be. The Buddha was reluctant to accept any notion of paramattha as ultimate reality. Instead, he claimed to know the dependently arisen and on that basis formed the conception of dependent arising. In such a context, it was more meaningful to him to speak of artha, artha, and paramattha in the sense of fruit, consequence, or result. Thus, a good action is one that is fruitful and a bad one is unfruitful. The Buddha also recognizes that views about good and bad, purity and impurity, are in most cases relative conventions. According to the same text, good kusala and bad akusala are conventions that vary upon contexts. These are the ways of the world, often characterized as samuti, vahara, or panyati. However, there is no indication that since these are relative conceptions, the Buddha advocated the transcendence of both good and bad. Having defined the good as the fruitful, the Buddha characterized the ultimately good as the ultimately fruitful. The term paramattha was thus used to refer to the ultimate fruit rather than the ultimate reality. And that's in fact the only way that you find paramattha used in the suttas. Okay, so in the suttas, when they use the word paramattha, which occurs very rarely, it always means nibbana. It's the ultimate or the highest fruit. Okay, it doesn't refer to an ultimate reality. Samuti as convention and paramattha are therefore not two contrasting truths. The former is a mixed bag, while the latter represents the ultimate ideal. As a result of attaining nibbana, which is the complete eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion, the Buddha found himself enjoying an ultimate fruit without hurting himself or others. Paramattha thus becomes the moral ideal as reflected in the Buddha's own attainment of freedom and happiness. The theory of dependent arising thus accommodates the four truths as well as the two truths, all truths being pragmatic. There is here no place for an absolute or ultimate reality. The Buddha's epistemological standpoint does not allow for such speculations. This, however, was not the case with the metaphysicians, by which he means the Abhidhamma scholars. It is significant to note that when the Buddhist metaphysicians were faced with the problems of reconciling their Four Noble Truths with their conception of substance, swabhava, again the real existence of things that we found all the way through here, they were compelled to fall back on the conception of two truths. However, their interpretation of the two truths is totally different from the Buddha's and in fact seems to be contrary to it. Here again, Vasubandhu is our source. So here he's quoting from the explanation of the two truths found in Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu wrote the Abhidharma Kosha, so without getting into the complexities of Vasubandhu and his position, but just to note that essentially what Vasubandhu writes is what people in the Tibetan tradition and those in the Chinese tradition who are aware of it would call Abhidharma. Okay? Of course, he's only one of them, but he's the main one who's referred to as Abhidharma. Vasubandhu refers to two truths, satya, and surreptitiously moves on to a discussion of existence, sangriti sat and paramartha sat. He then provides two examples to illustrate the nature of conventional truth. The first is a pot. There cannot be the knowledge of a pot when it's broken into pieces. The second example is water. The water is not known independent of the knowledge of form, rupa. Contrasted with these two is the knowledge of the paramartha sat. So that was the cup of tea we were talking about earlier, which has both a pot and the water inside it, you see? So it combines both of those examples in one. Material form, so then that's the conventional truth, conventionally existing thing, and the material form is an example of ultimate truth, something that exists ultimately. In such a case, when an object is broken down to its ultimately irreducible elements, namely atoms, paramanu in Pali, there is knowledge of the unique nature, swabhava or swalakshana, of such atoms. For the Abhidhamma scholars, that unique nature has always remained an epistemological enigma. This interpretation of the two truths is totally absent either in the early discourses or in the canonical Abhidhamma. In the so-called Theravadan tradition, it appears for the first time in the non-canonical texts, and he notes first time it appearing in the Milindapanha, contributing as it did in the case of the Sarvastivada and Sautrantika schools to insoluble problems such as the duality of mind and matter. Vasubandhu's statement of the two truths, Samvritti and Paramartha, in the above context, where he was recording the interpretation of the Sautrantika view, remains in sharp contrast to the spirit of the Buddha's teachings on non-substantialism. Okay, so here we have, so just again to summarize, I know that this is a complicated argument here, but just to summarize that very briefly, that when we're talking about the two truths, okay, if we follow, again, just to if we follow Kala Pahana's argument, that in the suttas, that the word paramartha, or ultimate, was only used to describe nibbana. And it meant that it's the ultimate goal or the ultimate fruit of our practice, okay? And the loka sangriti satchang is those things which pertain to the world, i.e. those things which fall short of nibbana. And so there's no sense of saying that one is more real than the other, okay? They're both real, but one is sort of conventional and relative. It's a limited fruit, and then the other is the highest fruit. So the tradition in the Abhidhamma became to change the meaning of that, instead of talking about what's the highest goal of practice, but to talk about what's the ultimately existing things. And so that the self or conventional existing things like a glass were said to be only relatively existing, whereas the ultimate atoms, if you like, of matter and also psychological atoms, the chittas and jaitisikas of the Abhidhamma, was said to be existing in the ultimate sense. So this is, so then the argument would be, and one could argue both ways, whether what Nagarjuna says here is what particular conception of these truths is he's making here. And again, just to repeat what he actually says, the teaching of the doctrine of the Buddhas is based on two truths. The truth relating to worldly convention and the truth in terms of highest fruit or ultimate reality, depending on how you want to translate paramartha. Okay. Yeah. Those who do not understand the distinction between these two truths do not understand the profound truth embodied in the Buddha's message. Okay. He then goes on to say, without relying on conventions, the ultimate goal, the ultimate truth, the Paramartha, is not taught. And without understanding the highest truth of the ultimate goal, freedom is not attained. Nirvana nadi gamyate. Okay, so
he's there saying that the highest truth is the Kalapahana's
interpretation,
Paramartha.
Yeah,
Paramartha. Yeah. Is actually Nirvana. So you can't say two verses down. He's treating them as if they're two separate things.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a reasonable argument, although that would have to be understood in terms of. But also understand that in terms of that Nagarjuna is all the way through being argued that you can't separate a cause from its effect, yeah. So it's not as easy as that. But certainly this statement here is quite important and quite straightforward, because often it becomes a tendency in Buddhist philosophy to deprecate the conventional truths. And so you find this is very characteristic of Abhidhamma discourse and Theravadan Abhidhamma discourse. Oh yes, this is only conventional truth. Therefore, it's nothing which is particularly important. But what we're teaching is ultimate truth. In fact, even if you're teaching ultimate truth, you have to use conventions to teach it. You have to use words. You have to use language. So you're always relying on conventions to realize things. Now that's a problem which you find quite commonly in the modern Abhidhamma, but it also should be noted that it doesn't actually, at least in theory, apply to the classical Theravadan position. The actual commentarial position, the classical Theravadan position, is that the Nibbana can be realized relying on either conventional or ultimate truth. Okay, because you can see there's many, many kind of stories where somebody will realize the Dhamma by reflecting about the nature of sickness or something like that. You know, they might reflect, my life is, they reflect on their body, for example, decomposing or these kinds of things which are regarded as conventional reality, and not sort of investigating the ultimate realities of the Abhidhamma. So again, according to the Theravadan, at least the classical tradition, it said that you can actually realize the Dhamma using either the method of conventional reality or of ultimate reality, although that tends to be overlooked a lot of the time in the contemporary Abhidhamma schools.
Is ultimate reality something that the Buddha never actually referred to?
Never actually referred to, So this is the problem, that if you're practicing within these traditions, that you're supposed to be, examining these so-called ultimate realities, which are not mentioned any time within 1,000 years after the Buddha actually lived.
So this is something like the particles thing. They think that's the ultimate reality.
Exactly. The paramanu of the atoms.
Yeah.
Kalapas. Kalapa is like a molecule. Yeah, so Kalapa is like a cluster of things which function together.
Ultimate reality, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
What is study quantum mechanics really like? Study ultimate reality?
I mean, there are those who would argue that if you meditate according to the systems, you are actually studying quantum reality from an internal point of view. So the problem with that, of course, is that next year the physicists come along and say that the quantum level of reality is not the ultimate level, and there's something which goes deeper. So the next and the nice verse is again that the wrongly perceived emptiness, durdrishta shunyata, destroys a person of meager intelligence, like a snake that is wrongly grasped or knowledge that is wrongly cultivated. My dad always used to say, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. So basically that's what Nagarjuna was saying. I should quote that to my dad. Thus, this is why the Buddha's mind recoiled from teaching the Dhamma after having reflected on the difficulty of understanding the doctrine by people of little intelligence. And he then goes on to say, give a disclaimer, a legal disclaimer here. Furthermore, if you were to generate any proliferation, any papancha, regarding, generate any obsession. I use a different word here. Anytime, adhilayam. If you were to generate any obsession, in other words, if you were to make a problem with regarding emptiness, this is not our fault. It's not my fault, right? And that obsession is not appropriate in the context of the empty. Right? So this is the legal disclaimer here. I'm not responsible for your misunderstandings. Everything is pertinent. Everything is suitable, okay, or is appropriate. It's not saying for those for whom emptiness is suitable. Everything is not suitable for those for whom emptiness is not suitable. Oh, hang on, no, sorry, I mistranslated that. I should go back again. Everything is pertinent for whom emptiness is proper. Everything is not pertinent for whom the empty is not proper. Notice how he changes between shunyang and shunyata here, which is quite interesting. Actually, this is a point of interpretation in the Heart Sutra as well, but I won't go into that. But I think it's saying that if you get it, then you'll understand. If you get emptiness, you'll understand the whole thing. You know, as long as you don't get it, you'll continue to miss out.
If you don't get it, you don't get it.
Yeah. If you do get it, you'll get everything. Yeah. So, and then he goes on to say, it's your fault, attributing your mistakes to me, you're like one who's mounted his horse and is confused about it. Okay? Reminds me of the Ajahn Chah simile of the horse. He said the simile of a horse. Don't know that one? So somebody asked once Ajahn Chah, what's delusion? He said, how do you know delusion? Yeah, you can know greed and hatred, but how do you know delusion? Yeah, because you're always deluded about it. So how do you recognize it? And so Ajahn Chah said, "Well, you're like someone who's riding around on a horse, and you're saying, 'Where's the horse? Where's the horse?'" Yeah, and of course but this was being said to someone who's asking the question in English, right? And so the translator misheard it because to ride a horse in Thai is kima, right? But if you get the tones wrong, you say kima. Right, which means dog shit. So he translated as, you're like someone who's shoveling dog shit and you're asking, where's the dog, where's the dog? So it kind of works both ways. So. Okay, so, and he then goes on to then assert, Nagarjuna then asserts, you also contradict the notions of effect, cause, agent, performance of action, activity, arising, ceasing, as well as fruit. So in other words, he's saying that, you know, because you don't get it, you don't get emptiness, then you then misconstrue all of these different things which you're supposed to be explaining. What the Abhidhamma is supposed to be explaining these concepts, but because they don't get the basic understanding of the nature of emptiness, they get everything else wrong and give a misunderstanding of everything else. And then there's a very important statement here. Whatever is dependent origination, it is precisely that is emptiness. That is dependent upon convention. And that itself is the middle way. Pratipatti saiva madhyama. So this is a very important statement. He identifies dependent origination with emptiness. Now this is an interesting point because there's actually nowhere in the Pali Canon which explicitly identifies dependent origination with emptiness. Yes, you can find concepts and ways of associating them, but it's not explicitly stated. But in the Sarvastivadin Agamas, it actually does say precisely that, that dependent origination is emptiness. It's in the Nidana Samyutta. It's one of the few doctrinal distinctions. So here, when stating that dependent origination is emptiness, remembering that Nagarjuna all the way through is arguing as if he's trying to convince people who are already familiar with the Agama Sutras, okay? So this is the Abhidhamma culture that he was working with. He assumed that they're familiar with the Agama Sutras and that they reject this teaching of emptiness because of their insistence on the actual existent reality of existent things. And so he's trying to, and then he was being criticized as saying your notion of emptiness destroys the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and so on. And he's saying, no, it's actually dependent origination itself which is emptiness. And in doing so, he was referring back to an early sutta, which he would have assumed that his audience would have known.
So he said, this is what he said in the Hasutta?
No, he didn't write the Hasutta.
No, he said, no Four Noble Truths.
Right.
Something like that.
Right.
So which is similar.
Exactly, yeah. So this, you know, the Heart Sutra is almost like deliberately provoking a response that, you know, you can feel in this interlocutor who Nagarjuna is imagining, who may be, you know, maybe somebody who is at the monastery with or something like that. You know, you can see how they would get, you know, you're teaching there's no Four Noble Truths and so on. The Heart Sutra is actually like deliberately setting out to provoke that kind of response, right? The Heart Sutra just straight out says there's no truths, there's no practice, there's no dependent origination, there's no khandas, yeah, all of these things. And so it deliberately tries to stir up this response as much as possible from the Abhidhammikas. And so here Nagarjuna is arguing about it, so it's a similar kind of, the same argument, but here he's discussing about it. He's saying, no, it's you're the one who's misunderstood the Four Noble Truths.
So when he speaks about he's just referring to what we are labeling them as, like birth, old age, and all this. He's referring to them that all these labels are actually just labels. It's not actually what is real. That is why it's empty.
Yeah, yeah. And the interdependent. See, also remembering that then. That the conception of dependent origination, which Nagarjuna would argue against, okay, is a conception of dependent origination which would be like, say, a row of dominoes. Okay? You bring the dominoes along. The dominoes exist prior to what's happened, and they're brought into a relationship, and they exist as independently existing things, and that they then condition each other and affect each other. Yeah? So that would be perhaps an example of how Nagarjuna would critique the Abhidhammika explanation of dependent origination. That you're assuming that there is prior existent things and you then have to work out some relationship between them. Whereas what the Buddha actually taught was there's this relationship. You actually see things occurring in relationship and you then try to describe that relationship by teasing out some words and phrases and ideas and concepts and ways of looking at it that can help you to understand so you can be free from it. But you shouldn't misconstrue that description of the reality with being the reality itself. So this is why he uses the term here with dependent origination is emptiness, okay? Sa prajñapti rupadaya. That is, how do you translate it in English? Prajñapti a derived description. Yes, upadaya panyati is a very standard, very important term in Buddhist philosophy. And it means, upadaya means dependent or arising from something. And the panyati is a description. Okay, so dependent origination itself is just a description which arises in dependence on things.
So, it's still something to do with conditions, giving rise to another condition.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's not the assumption that the things exist in and of themselves. And you then have to see, if they exist in and of themselves, how do they relate to each other? And how can it be that they actually condition each other? Yeah. So this is, again, one of the most foundations of Nagarjuna's argument. How can there be a swabhava, self-existent, as we found in the first chapter, how can something exist by itself if it's also been conditioned by others? So this, in the history of philosophy, this is a major problem, and in the West, Western philosophy also. That's why Kalpahana referred earlier to the mind-body problem and other problems. And a lot of these problems in Western philosophy come from exactly the same basis, like, you know, the mind-body problem. You know, you assume that there's a thing called the mind, and you assume that there's a thing called a brain or a body, and then you ask, how are these two things related to each other? Because you've already assumed from the beginning that they're separately existing things. Yeah, there's two Sunyata suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, and of course it comes up, it's mentioned in passing in a lot of other places as well. We've got a book downstairs that discusses that, Majjhima Munkit, on emptiness in the early discourses. And he notes, I think in there he notes that difference where the arguments actually mention that dependent origination is emptiness. I'll see if I can find the sutta. I would hesitate before saying the most important. Certainly, they're an important line. Yeah. And origination of emptiness. Yeah. Okay, so as another contender for his most important. Verses. These are another pair of verses which are also quoted a lot. And just to give a bit of context here, he's coming out of a discussion of Nibbana. It's part of a chapter on Nibbana. And there's a lot of things here. I'll just mention just in briefly, how could Nibbana be both existence and non-existence? For the simultaneous existence in one place is not possible, as in the case of light and darkness. The proposition that freedom is neither existence nor non-existence could be established if and when both existence and non-existence are established. Okay? So here he's saying that you could say Nibbana is either existent or non-existent. If you can say that anything, if you can establish these basic ideas of existence and non-existence, which of course is what his whole critique has been to demolish. If freedom as neither existence or nor non-existence is evident by means of what is it made known as neither existence nor non-existence? And then he goes on, it is not assumed that the Blessed One, the Tathagata, exists after death. Neither is it assumed that he does not exist or both or neither. And here again, Nagarjuna's quoting from and referring to a well-known and broadly accepted teaching found in the early Agama Sutras. It is not assumed that even a living Blessed One really exists. And again, this is what's said in the Agama Sutra, if the Tathagata even here and now can't be said to exist. Neither is it assumed that he does not exist or both nor neither. And I'll just mention that briefly to give a little bit of context here. He then goes on to make one of his more controversial. So these again, notice his rhetorical method. He starts out by making these statements where he's quoting from well-known and accepted passages which are using the same kind of logic which Nagarjuna uses. And he then goes on to extend that logic in quite a provocative way, making those kinds of statements which are more characteristic of Nagarjunian thought itself. And so his next verse is, the samsara has nothing that distinguishes it from Nibbana. Nibbana has nothing that distinguishes it from samsara. Okay, so the word samsara and Nibbana, visheshana is the distinction. Okay, there's and notice again, na asti, it does not exist, remembering the whole discourse on existence which this has been about, and there's no kinchi. There's no whatever. There's no whatever that distinguishes Nibbana and Samsara. There's no whatever that distinguishes between Samsara and Nibbana. Okay, so this, of course, is very influential and relates again to the Prajnaparamita thought and the idea that the identity of Nibbana and Samsara. But notice again how Nagarjuna is very, very subtle in what he's saying. Okay, so just there's no thing that can distinguish between Nibbana and Samsara. He's not saying that Nibbana and Samsara are identical, right? Okay, he's just saying, well. And ask yourself, is that actually true? If you start to look for a thing, a kimchi, and say, it's by this kimchi that we can distinguish between Nibbana and Samsara, then it becomes a bit difficult to actually think of anything. Well, is it a thing? Is that a kimchi? Yeah?
It depends on you. The kind of thing, but the process is also a thing, because it's a process, then rebirth is definitely a thing. And if Nibbana is not a thing,
there's a difference, yeah. So I think I think it would be again pointing to that thing of he's looking for kimchis, i.e. for really, truly, really existing things, would be the implication that the things as defined by the Abhidhammikas. Yeah? So if you look for any things.
How would you know if you were to? Is it because things are conditioned?
So,
one is just a condition, so there shouldn't be anything.
It slides off it, yeah? Yeah. So I mean, what to say about this, you know? I mean, you know, again, just what I find interesting about it is how provocative he was in his thinking, you know, just to sort of come out and say these things, given he's got guts anyway. I just go on to the next one and see what that says. Sorry? Nagarjuna? Well, that would be an assumption, yeah.
I suppose it would be. But, I mean, surely you wouldn't know, you wouldn't be able to say one way or another unless you knew what the Nibbana was, unless you experienced it. How would you know? How would you answer something that you know?
Relate to the question that we mentioned right at the beginning on the basic two different schools of interpreting Nagarjuna. So the Prasangika school, which is adopted in Tibet and is the most common school, basically says that understanding Nagarjuna is basically the highest level of understanding. So if you understand him properly, you'll be able to get rid of all the defilements and realize Nibbana, basically. Okay, I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but they certainly say that he's like the highest philosophical expression. But the other way of looking at Nagarjuna is the Svatantrika view is that Nagarjuna is to see Nagarjuna in a much more limited context, that he's simply there in order to refute and to demolish certain conceptions of the Dhamma which were misleading. Yeah. And I personally tend to see Nagarjuna in that more limited context. And so if it's understood within that way, then you could say, well, no, you don't have to be an arahant to understand this difference between samsara and nibbana, because we're not talking about that on an ultimate level. We're just talking about getting rid of some mistaken ideas about nibbana and samsara. Yeah? And so again, remembering that this would be one of the projects of the Abhidhamma, is to find some kind of kimchi, some kind of really, truly, really, truly, really existing thing that you can use to say, you know, we've got a clear boundary line with Nibbana on one side and samsara on the other. Of course, the problem with that is that whenever you try to define things and to draw clear boundaries, there's always a leakage. You can always find a counterexample. And as Nagarjuna himself has shown time and time again, that he's very adept at finding these kinds of counterexamples and showing that the kind of distinctions that we think are very straightforward and obvious, actually, when we look at them more closely, are not so clear.
All the examples you've shown so far, I can see why he says that he doesn't contradict anything. My understanding is what the mind is. But I just think that this is somehow very contrary to what the Buddha, because the Buddha did make a distinction between samsara and nibbana, even though he didn't say what nibbana is. He keeps saying it's always referred to as what's not.
Yeah.
He still made a very clear distinction.
And
this is just in all division. So it seems like. Like really being bold.
He's been very bold, but of course the point is that obviously he knows that.
Yeah, that's why you think, okay, there's something to that which is deeper. It's not what's on the surface.
Maybe he is going too far, but
he's just angry.
I don't know, he's angry, but he likes playing around anyway. What? That's giving me a good idea. I'll make the fake Nagarjuna blog. You get this? I have the fake Steve Jobs blog, so you can't have even a fake Nagarjuna blog. Anyway, next one. Now this is another nice one. Nirvanasya Jayakoti. The first point, remembering that he'd already talked about the first point of samsara not being evident, as the Buddha said, the first point of nibbana and the first point of samsara, between them, there is not evident even the tiniest little pinchy that's different. Tiniest little thingy-wingy.
The tallest point of nibbana is nonsensical.
Yeah, which I think... It's an epistemological statement, and here he uses that same phrasing, vijjate, is to be evident. Yeah, so there's no evident, so this, again, this is a very interesting argument. Now, you get just to see the way that he's arguing. He starts out with this very kind of provocative statement, right? There's not the slightest thing that's different. And of course the immediate response is to say, no, everything's different, right? The samsara is birth, aging and death, and nibbana is the ending of birth, aging and death, right? So your first response is to say, there's nothing that, completely the opposite to Nagarjuna, actually there's nothing whatsoever in common between nibbana and samsara, right? So, but then he goes on in the next verse and says, well, at least there's something which is in common, which is that you can't find a first point for either of them. Yeah?
Can't find the first point.
What is the first point nibbana? When you get to there.
I think what we do is try to get there. And then, I heard the people that get there actually know the minute that they did.
Yeah, but that's their own realization of nibbana, but that's not nibbana itself.
What do you mean nibbana pocket?
Sorry?
We don't know whether that is the first point or last point.
No point.
Yeah.
So when you think about it in terms of samsara, well, there's been past Buddhas and things like that. So as long as there's samsara, then there's been Buddhas arising, and then there's been beings realizing nibbana. But the beings can't realize nibbana until they're in samsara. Right? So until you're suffering, you can experience the dukkha, you can then escape from it and realize nibbana. Yeah?
Nibbana
is dependent on samsara. Yeah.
Is someone reminds me of this chicken
puzzle? Exactly, yeah.
No way to answer.
Yeah.
But you could get to nibbana and finally be in something.
Yeah.
Nibbana is just like it's
timeless. The problem
is that
you're always in nibbana, you just have clouds over it. Yeah, that's what
you say. The problem is in Thai, chicken is the first letter of the alphabet, is Bo Kai, it's the chicken, and the second letter of the alphabet is Ko Kai, is an egg. So
what
if you ask chicken, Bo Kai.
Kai?
Ko Kai.
Ko Kai, can't
you understand? Ko Kai and Ko Kai. Aspirated and unaspirated, called Kai, yeah. So the first letter is an egg and the second one's a chicken. So if you say in Thai, which came first, the chicken or the egg, the answer is very obvious.
I don't say it's the egg.
Okay, well, that's it then. He needs to have an argument. He needs to have an argument with the time. Right, yeah. Okay, so I haven't got too much time, but the next chapter then is one which, according to Kalapahana, is one which is relatively neglected by Nagarjunian scholars, and is the examination of the 12 factors of dependent origination. And I might just read through this. It's one of the most straightforward, because this is giving a where he's actually reasserting those doctrines. You know, he's always been saying, well, no, I'm here to establish dependent origination, not to destroy it. And here is what he's actually saying about it. A person developed, enveloped by ignorance, performs such dispositions, such sankharas in the threefold ways leading to re-becoming. That's the threefold sankhara mentioned in the Nidana Sanyutta's meritorious, demeritorious, and imperturbable, which refers to the karma associated with the fourth jhana and above. So one developed by ignorance forms such dispositions, such sankharas in the threefold ways leading to rebirth, and through such actions he moves on to his destiny, not destiny in the normal sense, destiny in sense of the place where he's going, the next rebirth. Consciousness, with sankhara as its condition, enters a new life. When consciousness has entered, the nama rupa is it says infused here, is created, and the name and form is created. When the name and form has been created, the occurrence of the six spheres of sense takes place. Depending on the six spheres precedes contact. Thus, depending on the eye and material form and attention to, and depending on the nama rupa, precedes consciousness. Whatever is the harmonious concurrence of the three factors, the external form, the consciousness, and the eye, is contact. Feeling proceeds from such contact. So here he's pretty much just restating the doctrines found time and time again in the Agama Sutras. Conditioned by feeling is craving. Indeed, craving is directed by feeling. One who craves grasps onto the fourfold spheres of grasping. That's the four kinds of upadana, which is grasping at sensual, sensitive eye, karma upadana, ditta upadana, grasping at views, grasping at silabhata, as at precepts and practices, and grasping at theories of self, atavada upadana. When grasping exists, there is becoming, or is bhava, rebirth, on the part of the grasper. If he were to be a non-grasper, he would be released, and there would be no further existence. The five aggregates constitute this existence. From existence proceeds birth relating to decay and death, grief, lamentation, dejection, and despair, all of these to proceed from birth, such as the occurrence of this entire mass of suffering. Okay, and then he goes on to describe the cessation of all of those things. So in that doctrine, after his whole 25 chapters on emptiness and getting rid of all views and so on, he then re-establishes, in a very conventional sense, the dependent origination, having identified dependent origination itself with emptiness. And then the final chapter here is the chapter on views, where he again focuses on the eternalism and annihilationism views. And here, I'll just read his last couple of verses here. Thus, because of the emptiness of all existence, all the bhavas, again, where, to whom, which, and for what reason would views such as the eternal ever occur? Okay? So in other words, if you understand the emptiness, and you understand the emptiness of all existent things, then why would you have any of these kind of views? And then the final verse, I bow with reverence to Gautama, who out of compassion, Anukampangupadaya, has taught the true doctrine in order to relinquish all views. Sarva Drishti Pahamaya. That's the last verse on the Madhyamaka Karika. So there you go, there's Nagarjuna. So, as you remember, that the relinquishing of all views is. Yes and no. Relatively, yes. Yeah. Well, if you think about right view, it's not actually that mysterious. Think about right view as a testable hypothesis. Yeah. So you say, I have a hypothesis, right? And that's exactly what the way the word view or dritti is actually used in that way. Okay. So in Thai, the theory of evolution is called the tritsiti hang gan vivat. It's literally the theory of evolution, and the tritsiti is the drishti. So, if you think about it as a thesis to be confirmed or denied, right, then you have this. Then when it's confirmed, you say, well, do you have this hypothesis anymore? Well, no, I don't have this hypothesis. Yeah? I can see it. You can say, well, I think tomorrow is going to rain. I have this hypothesis, tomorrow is going to rain. The next day you're walking outside and it's pouring rain and you're getting soaked through. Do you have the hypothesis that it's going to rain anymore? Well, no, I don't have that hypothesis. It's actually raining. Yeah? So it's relinquished in that sense. Okay, so that's enough. A bit of an introduction to Nagarjuna 101. So from next week, I think we'll probably do another couple of weeks of this philosophy class. I was going to look at Vasubandhu and a few other things, but I probably won't. I'm going on. Yeah.
You're going, so there's no option.
Where are you going? But this is
it. I'm neither coming nor going. No. I'm going to visit my dad.
You're going for a week, then
I'm going to visit my dad.
And then you're going again.
Am I?
Yeah, you're going to the retreat.
That's all a bit empty, isn't it? So, yes. So next week will have to be the end of it for now. But what I will do, okay? So what I'll do next week is I'll give an introduction to the Visuddhimagga 101. All right. So if you want to read the Visuddhimagga between now and then, okay. Be my guest. All right. So let's finish by paying respects.